Little by little, year by year, the core of our spiritual being will be refined by grace and become more sensible to the breathing of God, of the Spirit of Love, within us. Little by little, we shall be divinized and our external life will become the manifestation, the epiphany of our interior life. We shall be holy because in our innermost being we shall be closely united to God all holy. We shall be fruitful, and rivers of living water will flow from us because we shall be joined to the very wellspring of life. Dear friends, this is the essential advice that you ask of me. May it guide you safely to the hour of mental prayer in your remote bushland. I shall sum it up in a few words. To engage in mental prayer is to go on a pilgrimage to the sanctuary within, and there to adore the true God. And if you want your whole life to become one long prayer, a life in God's presence, a life with God, if you want to become souls of prayer, you must, throughout the day, enter often within yourselves to adore the God who is expecting you there. It need not be for long. An instant's plunge inward, and then you can return to your tasks, your conversations, but you will return rejuvenated, refreshed, renewed. In 17th century France there lived a humble Carmelite lay brother, Lawrence of the Resurrection, who was well advanced in the spiritual life. He liked to tell those who came to him for advice, that there was no more effective way of attaining to a life of continual mental prayer, and hence a high degree of sanctity, than faithfulness to this practice. Hear his words: during our work and our other activities, even when we are engaged in spiritual reading and writing, I say, even more, during our external devotions and vocal prayers, we must stop briefly, as often as we can, to adore God deep within our heart, to delight in Him even if only in passing and as if by stealth. Zero Lord, I love the house in which you dwell, the tenting place of your glory. PS 26:8. When the Jews recited this psalm, they thought of the temple of Jerusalem. The Christian, for his part, thinks of his baptized soul. 3. Speak to him. A few weeks ago, I visited a Trappist monastery. The guest master welcomed me, and led me to the prior's office through the long, bright halls, redolent of poverty and silence. I entered a room with whitewashed walls, devoid of ornamentation and pictures, where a man of silence and serenity awaited me. His face was at once rugged and suffused with gentleness. A gentleness that did not speak to the senses but was completely spiritual, and that softened the sharp contours and hollows of his ascetical mask. In his glance, the candor of a child and the wisdom of old age mingled harmoniously. Our conversation took on a note of mutual trust. He was moved to speak of the day long ago which decided the course of his life. As an adolescent, he took part in the activities of a large Parisian church-related youth group. One Thursday, during the winter, after a long afternoon of games, the curate talked about prayer to the older youths gathered in the small chapel. Our young man stayed on after his comrades, ostensibly to help the curate put things in order. Actually, he wanted to ask him something, but he scarcely knew how to go about it. Finally, while sweeping the room, which was less embarrassing than in a tete-a-tete, he blurted out, "You're always telling us that we should pray, but you never teach us how to do it." The priest answered, "That's true. Do you want to know how to pray? Well, Frangui, just go into the chapel and when you're there, speak to him." That evening, I went to the chapel. The old monk continued, "I must have stayed a long time, because I remember getting home late and being severely reprimanded. For the first time in my life, I had prayed. And I do believe that, ever since, I have never stopped speaking to him." When he had finished making his disclosure, the father prior was silent. From a certain inflection in his voice, I understood that this memory from the distant past had had an emotional impact on him, for it was the first link in a long intimacy with his God. The silence continued. I did not dare break it. I was sure he was speaking to him. Most certainly, He was thanking him for leading him, when he was a lad of 15, to the priest who had directed his steps in the paths of prayer. The curate's advice was only apparently banal. He was really proving that he was an experienced man of prayer who, rather than engage in a long discourse, was content to answer the teenager eager to learn to pray, with three words, "Speak to him." We do not converse with shadows. In order to talk to God, we must become aware of His presence. And to know what to say to Him, our faith must wake up and start searching. The need to formulate words prevents us from being satisfied with flimsy impressions. It forces us to express precise thoughts, intentions, sentiments. The merits of such a method are great, if one can really call this simple advice a method. Many Christians, when they go to mental prayer, allow themselves to be lulled into nebulous reveries, to pity themselves, and fall asleep in the sweet warmth of vague pious emotions. They never succeed in focusing their minds on anything, because they are incapable of concentration. If they would only listen to and follow the curate's advice. But perhaps they would spurn it either out of pride or spiritual sloth, because they imagine that they are further advanced in the paths of mental prayer, or because they refuse to make the necessary effort. I thought I could give no better answer to your recent letter, than to relate my conversation with the Trappist monk. You, too, want to learn how to pray. Why don't you listen to the Parisian curate's advice, and put it into practice? A day will come when you will no longer need any words for your mental prayer. If I dare say so, you will have attained proficiency in the trade. Or more precisely, grace will have advanced its work in you. But don't try to rush forward. For the moment, speak to him. 4. The advice of the old parish priest. I recently met a Savoyard peasant who, in addition to his regular work, has assumed heavy responsibilities in agricultural organizations. I had been told of the rather extraordinary influence he had on others as a Christian. We met and talked to each other about our respective activities. When I spoke to him about the Cahiers Zurvösen, his interest visibly doubled. Sensing that his reaction intrigued me, he volunteered to satisfy my curiosity. When I was young, I often served the mass of our old pastor. He was a strange man, rough, surly, silent, a man we feared a little, and loved, or rather revered, very much. We hesitated to turn to him about ordinary matters of daily life, but when we were in trouble we went at once to consult him at his rectory, which was more austere than a monk's cell. He spent hours on end in prayer at the church. One day, when I was about 14, I said to him, "Father, I'd like to know how to pray, too." My words must have had an extraordinary effect on him, because he smiled in a way that can't be put into words, and he was a man nobody had ever seen smiling. I have since speculated that he had been praying all his life that someday someone would ask him that question. He looked so happy that I thought he was going to talk to me for a long time, right there in the sacristy filled with the vague scent of incense. Unfortunately, I can't find words to describe his clear-eyed look, his look of intense purity. But I can at least give you his answer verbatim. It was very short: "When you go to God, lad, think very hard that He is there, and say to Him, 'Lord, I place myself at your service.'" Apostrophe. And then, in his ordinary surly tone, he continued, "Come now, hurry and put your cassock away." I later came to understand that his abrupt manner was really a form of bashfulness. That day, I learned how to pray. And it will soon be 40 years that I have practiced mental prayer by placing myself at God's service. Come now, admit this story is worth a whole conference on mental prayer, and dispense me from writing you at greater length today. But try to understand what it means to be at God's service. It has far-reaching implications. We must first give up our right to dispose of ourselves. We must surrender totally to God, entrusting ourselves to His discretionary power, and that includes our body, our intellect, our heart, our will, our very life, so that He may dispose of us as He pleases. But what's the use of trying to explain? Words are powerless to make one understand. Pray to the old pastor who must not be surly anymore, now that he has found the one whom he was seeking, that he may obtain for you the grace to be totally at God's service. 5. Being present to God. Share your impression that your spiritual life has now reached a plateau. After reflecting and praying, I came to the conclusion that that's the way things are going to be, as long as you do not make a larger place for prayer in your life. And by prayer, I mean essentially what is usually referred to as mental prayer. It used to be called oraison, from the Latin oratio. For the Romans, orare meant addressing a prayer to the gods, pleading a cause, and, in a derived sense, making a discourse. Mental prayer is a conversation of the soul with God. That is the way spiritual men and women have always understood it. Clement of Alexandria wrote, "I dare say that mental prayer is a conversation with God." For Saint Benedict, it is attending to God. For Saint Teresa of Avila, mental prayer is a friendly exchange in which one converses in a tete-a-tete with this God by whom one knows he is loved. For Dom Marmion, it is a talk between the child of God and his heavenly Father, under the guidance of the Holy Spirit. These words, conversation and talk, involve the risk, however, of encouraging a certain ambiguity, because they give one to believe that mental prayer consists essentially in speaking inwardly to God. Now, mental prayer is a vital action that involves our whole being. There is an expression which, if it is given its true depth of meaning, could translate quite well the interior action of the man or woman who is praying, being present to God. To help you grasp my thought, allow me to call to mind an event that must have remained very vivid in your memory. I had come to pay you a visit. As you opened the door, you informed me that your daughter Monica probably had meningitis, and you led me to her room plunged in semi-darkness. Your wife was sitting next to the little bed, silent, intensely attentive to her child's poor emaciated face. At times, she would gently push a lock of hair from Monica's forehead. When the child opened her eyes, she responded by smiling, the kind of smile that words cannot describe. Whatever the mother did, whether she was tidying things up in the room or taking a hasty meal in the neighboring room, she remained intensely present to her daughter. Every fiber of her being, every second of her life, was directed toward Monica. That's the way it is, or at least should be, with mental prayer. It should be a profound attention of the soul, an exchange that goes beyond words which, without neglecting to speak, consists of something very different, an attention, a presence to God of one's whole being, body and soul, of all one's keenly alert faculties. Do I need to take more time to plead the cause of mental prayer with you? I have every reason to think that the cause is already won, that you are not among the many Christians who refuse to admit the need for it. I shall not hide from you that I have a bad conscience when I need to multiply arguments in order to invite the sons of God to come close to their Father, to open their hearts to His revelations, to live in His close friendship, to express their love and gratitude to Him. How strange that there is a need to insist, so that beings endowed with understanding may strive to know the something that is most interesting of all. So that beings created for love may come to love the something that is most lovable. So that free beings may place themselves at the Lord's service, rather than at the service of His vassals. So that beings created for happiness may not be content with small pleasures. 6. Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening. IS 3:9. Do you remember what you were telling me one day about Philip? He is a very obliging boy, always ready to do my errands.